Great. Well, once again, welcome to session three of Big Business and the Market, Friends or Foes. Tonight's class is titled Power and Market, How Government Affects Business. And of course, many of you will recognize that title, Power and Market, as being the title of one of the classic books by Murray Rothbard on the relationship between the economy and the state. It's been a pleasure visiting with all of you, having these discussions with you last week. I'm looking forward to doing it again this week. It's great to be team teaching with Professor Cardin, from whom I've learned a lot and who has added a lot of insight to our discussions. I'm a little unhappy that he chose to wear a tie for his lecture last week, but hopefully he has a chance to make up for it by wearing a tank top on Thursday of this week. Last week was really kind of laying the groundwork for the real meat of the course, which I think begins today. Last week we had one lecture and discussion on the nature of the firm, the nature of the business enterprise, followed by a lecture on the nature of the state. Since we're talking about big business and big government, during this class, we wanted to kind of lay out some basics on what business is, what business does, how business firms operate, what it means to be a business enterprise, to contrast that with the way that states or non-market organizations behave. And with those foundations having been laid, we want to move on today to talk about some specific ways in which firms and the state, business and the government, interact. You know, does government affect business? Well, of course it does. Just as government affects all aspects of our lives, especially the kind of interventionist governments that we have in all parts of the world today. But business also affects government, right? So there's a close and kind of incestuous relationship between market actors and non-market actors, and we want to try to understand those relationships a little bit more carefully starting today. So one of the readings that I assigned was two of the chapters from Mises' 1929 book, A Critique of Interventionism, which I think does a very nice job laying out some basics of what an interventionist state is and how it differs from other forms of other kinds of states. So let me start with some definitions. Right, the way Mises defines economic systems is as according to this three-way categorization scheme. Right, capitalism is a system of the division system using the division of labor with private ownership of the means of production. That's the hallmark of a market-based capitalist order, according to Mises. Right now, as corollaries, right, when you have a division of labor and private ownership of productive means, that results in people cooperating, right? Cooperation of many individuals and groups, none of whom owns all the capital goods, and therefore none of whom makes all the decisions about the allocation of productive resources in the economy, right? Those of you familiar with Leonard Reed's classic essay, I, Pencil, understand that this cooperation across the market is not always conscious and deliberate, right? Indeed, there's unconscious coordination of many, many individuals and groups that's necessary even to produce the simplest of consumer goods like the classic pencil. There are some ground rules for this kind of cooperation in Mises' system, right? Property rights, protection for property rights, and regulation of economic activity through contract, right, and gift and exchange as well. So individuals own the means of production. Means of production resources are owned by individuals who may exchange these means with others or give them away. And then the products that are produced, the consumer goods that are produced by these productive means are also exchanged in markets. So a lot of our discussion last week in the Tuesday lecture on the nature of the firm, the nature of business enterprise, took for granted an institutional environment in which there was private property, right, in which there's private ownership of the means of production, There are free markets for capital goods, for labor, for consumer goods. Prices are set by bargaining between buyers and sellers and so forth. We can certainly contrast that kind of a system with socialism. Right, so Mises is very precise about how he defines capitalism and socialism. Socialism is a system in which one individual or group controls all the means of production. Right, so decisions about what will be produced and how goods and services will be produced, right, which combinations of heterogeneous capital resources will be used to manufacture consumer goods and services, are all in the hands of one person or one group or one party or one board. Right? The distinctive feature of socialism, according to Mises, is the idea of what he calls one will acting, a phrase that he uses in his classic article on socialism from 1920. Right? So whether the government, the central planner, is affiliated with the Communist Party, whether it's some kind of a fascist dictator, whether it's a collective, it doesn't matter to Mises, right? It's not the political system that's important. What's important is how decisions are made about the allocation of productive resources. If there's one single decision-making body, then that is a socialist economy, according to Mises. So cooperation in this setting is not based on exchange, not based on voluntary exchange, but on some other mechanism, right? It might be dictatorial fiat, the whim of the great leader. It might be even democratic elections, right? So socialism and democracy are not incompatible in this sort of scheme, right? People can elect the members of the planning board or vote on individual production decisions, but as long as the decisions are made collectively, such that there's only one decision maker, then that's a socialist economy, according to Mises. When Mises wrote this book on interventionism in the 1920s, it's a collection of essays, and the lead essay is one that Mises wrote for an encyclopedia a few years earlier, dealing with the theory of price controls. And Mises tried to think systematically about what is the economic essence of price controls? Well, in an economy in which prices are controlled, there may still be private ownership of the means of production, right? At least nominally, factories, resources, raw materials, machines, and so on, are in the hands of private owners. These owners have property titles, they have ownership certificates, they have some legal rights to how their property is used, but they may not have full de facto rights and how their property is to be used, because government policy constrains or limits these uses in some particular way. So there may be outright de jure public ownership of some means of production. Some industries may be nationalized or socialized, but in other industries there may be nominal private ownership, but de facto public control. And of course, price controls is only one example. You could have controls on quantities or qualities or working conditions, controls on advertising, information, other information flows, controls on location, and so forth, right? Any law that affects how the property owner is able to use that property, aside from the usual restrictions on not violating the property rights of other property owners, would be a characteristic of an interventionist system in this scheme. Now, one of Mises' key insights in his discussion of interventionism is the argument that these sort of middle way or third way system that's not purely socialist and not purely capitalist, but some kind of a mix, is ultimately an unstable system. And you may be familiar with Mises' argument that interventions rarely bring about the results that are desired by the interveners, at least the sort of ostensible public interest rationales that are given by the interveners, right? The government says that prices are too high and poor people can't afford to buy this particular good or service, so they institute price controls, which, as we know, results any attempt to impose minimum or maximum prices results in shortages and surpluses, If the price is kept artificially low, that results in excess demand for the good or service, and you end up with shortages on the shelves. People hoard the good, and the resulting allocation of resources is not what the central planners ostensibly desired. Right, so interventions of this type are never successful in increasing overall social well-being, however defined. Therefore, according to Mises, right, they would give rise, the failure of the initial intervention gives rise to calls for further intervention to correct, to correct the first intervention. Right, so a hurricane is approaching and the government passes laws against price gouging that results in shortages of necessary goods and services in the stores. So the government passes another rule saying that, well, nobody can buy more than 2 or 3 units of the good at the artificially low price. Or suppliers are mandated by law to increase their inventories. Manufacturers are required to provide more to the retailers. Well, that results in some manufacturers shutting down, so the government has to pass laws forcing other people to enter the manufacturing industry and so forth. So there's this sort of cascade in which one regulation inevitably calls forth another intervention and yet another intervention and so on. And you end up going completely in the direction of socialism, according to Mises. What does this have to do with business-government relations? Well, of course, all modern economies, and indeed to a greater or lesser degree, all economies that have existed in history, have at least some government interventions. Now, the scale varies, right? So there's some societies that have relatively little government intervention in the marketplace, in economic activities, others that have much more, right? But all of us now are operating in some kind of interventionist society. So under interventionism, the relationship between business and the state is far different than it would be under capitalism, in which the role of the state, for Mises, a classical liberal, would be very small, would be limited to adjudicating property disputes and enforcing contracts and so forth. For so-called anarchists or anarcho-capitalists like Murray Rothbard, the role of the state, there would be no need for a state at all under a capitalist system, because the market would be able to provide dispute resolution and adjudication and so forth on its own. Now, what's the rationale for interventionism? Well, Art covered this quite well in his lecture on Thursday of last week, right? Describing, or distinguishing between what we might call public interest and private interest rationales for interventionism, more generally, and for business regulation more specifically. Purported public interest rationales for government intervention in the economy include property rights enforcement, defining and enforcing property rights, and then in more difficult cases, redressing so-called market failures, externalities, public goods, monopoly pricing, and so on. Art did a good job describing these rationales and critiquing them last week. I call this the high school civics class version of what government is, right? So in the U.S., a lot of high school kids take a field trip to the state capitol or to Washington, D.C., and they learn from teachers or tour guides or other well-intentioned but often ill-informed persons what it is that government does. Well, government is here to provide all these necessary goods and services that we can't provide for ourselves. Politicians are here to help you. Government exists to improve public welfare and so on and so forth. We can call it the high school civics class version of government because if your high school civics class was anything like mine, it's completely naive, right? Unrealistic. It's not based on any sort of sound theory or, heaven forbid, solid empirical or historical research. It's just a series of slogans or mantras that are repeated in high school civics textbooks. It's certainly not based on scientific research, not based on the evidence. Art discussed some of the so-called public choice or private interest rationales for the state, building on North and others, last week, right? So, you know, what we might call a private interest view of government intervention in the market, government intervention in business, is that regulations and other forms of intervention benefit particular private interests, particular interest groups. Right, in some cases, this is pretty obvious. You know, a tariff, in the U.S., we have a tariff on imported sugar. Cane sugar can be produced very cheaply in the Caribbean, in South America, and Central America. We produce a little bit in the U.S., in Louisiana, and in Florida, but production costs are much higher than they are in the Caribbean and in Latin America. So we have a very high tariff that protects domestic sugar manufacturers. Right? I mean, it's pretty obvious to anybody who gives it even a moment's thought that the sugar tariff and subsidies for domestic sugar manufacturers is not good for American food consumers. Right? It's good for American sugar manufacturers, and it's also good for the American corn industry, right? Because by raising the prices of cane sugar, it increases the demand for high fructose corn syrup, also beet sugars and other substitutes that are more expensive and or lower quality than cane sugar. It harms foreign sugar manufacturers, and it harms domestic American sugar consumers, right? So the sugar tariff is a clear transfer of wealth from sugar consumers to domestic sugar producers. It's just a naked power grab. It's a naked money grab by the domestic sugar industry and the corn industry. You know, not only, it's not just a transfer, it's a net loss, right? Because society as a whole is made worse off as a result of that tariff than it otherwise would be. But you can understand how such a policy might come about if sugar manufacturers are particularly politically active or are good lobbyists and so forth. We'll talk about that in just a second. What about health and safety regulation and environmental regulation? You might think, well, isn't this something that, you know, harms all businesses because it increases their costs? They have to inspect their products more carefully. They have to protect the environment and so forth. They have to provide for disabled workers, et cetera. But if you study these policies more carefully, you see that the costs are typically distributed asymmetrically. They're not uniformly distributed across types of firms, right? Large firms, for example, can often meet these health, safety, and environmental regulations at a much lower per unit cost than small firms, right? Large companies, office buildings, shopping malls, and so on, they can install wheelchair ramps and the special bathrooms for access for the disabled and so on much more easily and at a much lower cost than a small mom and pop store, which maybe couldn't afford to install a wheelchair ramp or reconfigure the bathroom. That might be prohibitively expensive for the small firm. And in fact, you find in many cases, like with the Americans with Disabilities Act from the 90s mandating these kinds of things, that lobby groups representing large companies typically favored these rules, whereas groups representing smaller companies typically opposed them. Right? It's what economists call the principle of raising your rivals' costs. And so regulations that hurt you more than they hurt me are a net benefit to me, and I might support them. More generally, firms that are politically connected can use the regulatory system, can use interventionism more generally to their advantage. Right, and there's particular circumstances under which we would expect private interest regulations to be more prominent or prevalent or more successful. One is the old idea of concentrated benefits and dispersed costs. Right, if the benefits to a particular government policy are concentrated in the hands of a small, well-defined, easily identified group, where the costs are spread out over a larger, less well-identified, less well-defined group, well, then we would expect the political forces to be more likely to bring about that regulation. right, in the sugar industry case, the sugar tariff case, right, there's not that many sugar producers in the U.S. There's just a handful of them. They all know each other. They can easily form a lobbying group, a political action committee. They can go and lobby their congressmen and their senators. They can lobby the agriculture department and others to make sure that that tariff gets passed. Who is harmed by the tariff? Well, that's all of us, all Americans who consume sugar, right? So, you know, let's say there's, 500 sugar manufacturers, but there's 300 million sugar consumers, right? The transfer of wealth from consumers to producers is going to result in a pretty substantial chunk of change for those sugar producers, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars in additional income. Whereas, you know, as a sugar consumer, I just pay a few more cents on goods and services that I buy at the supermarket. So I don't even notice, right, the higher prices that I pay for sugar, the substitution away from sugar and towards corn syrup. As a consumer, I may not, number one, I may not be aware of it. And even if I am, you know, it doesn't hurt me enough for me to do anything about it. It's not worth my time to go march on Washington to get the prices of, you know, candy bars lowered by a few cents. The benefits to me personally outweigh the cost of my taking political action. So I don't do anything, right? And so the small, well-organized sugar industry is able to get what it wants at the expense of the large, diffuse, and poorly organized set of sugar consumers. The Bruce Yandel's famous idea of the bootlegger and Baptist coalition helps to illustrate this phenomenon pretty well also. And if you've read the article, you know that the metaphor of the bootlegger and Baptist refers to the private interest, sort of business interest, monetary interests who benefit from a specific regulation financially, and their sort of tacit partnership with groups of sort of public-spirited do-gooders who support the rule for ideological reasons, right? The example, of course, referring to prohibition in the 1920s, right? Bootleggers benefit from prohibition because it increases the sale of their bootleg alcohol. Baptist groups refer to those who favor the prohibition of alcohol for, you know, for moral reasons, because it's alcohol is bad for character, demon rum, and so forth. So Yandel's point is, the bootlegger groups rarely they work behind the scenes to get the rules that they want, and they rely on the so-called Baptist groups to make the case for them in public, right? Yandel, of course, is talking mainly about environmental regulation, and you have the Sierra Club and the Green Party and others who advocate for particular environmental rules, not knowing, most likely, that these rules also benefit particular private interests, you know, large manufacturing operations that are grandfathered in under the new rules, firms that benefit from raising rivals' costs, and so on. So where you have a bootlegger and Baptist coalition, according to Yandel, you're more likely to see that interventionism enacted, that particular intervention enacted, compared to cases where you have only a private interest or only a kind of a moral group making the moral case, but not both. So in other words, there are particular contexts when we can expect regulations that benefit private interests to be more likely to be enacted. Now, you know, this is not all about sort of pure financial gains and losses to various groups, right? There are much broader sort of social and cultural perspectives on business, whether business is good or bad for society, and how the state, how government should react to that. We referred in the little blurb that we wrote for the course to a famous essay by Ayn Rand called Big Business, America's Persecuted Minority. It's worth reading if you haven't read it before. Rand makes the case that in popular culture and, you know, in the media and government and so on, that big business is unjustly reviled, that no one appreciates the good that big business has done for society. you know, and I mentioned this Tuesday of last week, that, you know, in the movies and in books and so on, you know, the villain is almost always a business person. Business people are almost always portrayed in a negative light in popular culture. When you hear, you know, activists or people in the media complain about, you know, the 1% of the rich exploiting the 99%, you know, by the 1% they mean wealthy executives and, you know, investors and CEOs and so forth. You know, they never mean Barbara Streisand, who makes more money than, you know, almost all, more money than most CEOs. They don't mean LeBron James, who makes just as much money. They don't mean George Soros or other kind of do-gooders. Well, maybe they would include Soros, because he is a businessman. But you know, popular ire is almost always directed at people in the world of commerce, because, you know, business is all about exploiting selfish greed and getting what you want and taking advantage of other people and being dog eat dog and so on. Whereas you know, government and journalism and entertainment and so on are all about you know, providing valuable services to the public. You know, there are a lot of good things in Rent's essay, but there's a lot of things that I think she leaves out. And the essay has been rightly criticized from many different points of view for, you know, presenting a stylized, idealized version of so-called big business that, you know, may describe the heroes and heroines in Ayn Rand's novels that don't correspond very well to most real-world business people. Because most business people are, you know, are no more sinners or saints than any of the rest of us. And of course, in an interventionist society, you would expect business people to, you know, make the best use of the tools that they find around them, including interventionist policies, right? So most, historically, most successful business people, many successful business people, have of course turned to the state and use the state where it works to their advantage. This is not a condemnation per se of these particular business people, right? It's providing a more realistic and balanced perspective of what happens to business people, how business people act either by choice or because they feel they don't have a choice in a highly interventionist society. And just in terms of historiography, right, you know, the sort of traditional view of left liberals or progressives is that, you know, big business has, you know, since the Industrial Revolution, business sought to exploit the worker and exploit the consumer and, you know, had to be tamed by the beneficial actions of big government that stepped in to protect the consumer and to protect the worker against the deprivations of, you know, evil industrialists. It fell to a very important group of kind of left-wing progressive historians in the 1960s, the so-called New Left revisionist historians, to point out that that conventional picture is not at all historically accurate, in that big business and big government have often been close partners as modern capitalism and American capitalism progressed in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, right? Some of the important figures in this movement include the names you see in front of you, William Appleman Williams, James Weinstein, and the best known of all, Gabriel Kolko. Williams wrote a book on a revisionist account of American foreign policy, which was sort of the guru of this new left corporate liberal movement, arguing that American foreign policy had largely been motivated by serving special business interests, that powerful manufacturers and traders and so on sought to use the state and sought to influence foreign policy in ways that would open up, you know, particular markets, that would harm foreign competitors and so forth, that, you know, private business interests explained a lot of particular diplomatic moves in the 18th and 20th centuries. Weinstein's book on the progressive movement showed that progressive leaders were rather than being sort of hostile to business, were in fact working very closely with industrial interests, with business interests, to try to favor particular groups of manufacturers over others, that large firms in particular were strong beneficiaries of the progressive era regulation. And of course, the same would be true of World War I and the New Deal, et cetera. I'll give some examples in just a second. The best known of these figures is Gabriel Kolko. In his books, Railroads and Regulation and The Triumph of Conservatism in the 1960s. The Triumph of Conservatism famously argued that the progressive era, that the rise of the regulatory state in the U.S. was actually very conservative in the sense of serving established business interests rather than countering them or challenging them in any other way. Rothbard discusses some of this in his essay Left and Right that I ask you to read. Particularly in the middle part, there's a paragraph, I don't have it in front of me, but the paragraph where he says something like, now consider the American case, or let's look at how this has worked in America, halfway through the article, where he describes some of these specific examples, referring to people like Williams, Weinstein, and Kolko. Antitrust is a great example. It's been demonstrated quite convincingly by historians that the origins of antitrust have very little to do with kind of the standard story you get in a textbook history class or a textbook economics class, right? That, firms were getting too large, and so the government had to step in to break up these big monopolies. The market share of large manufacturers and other industrialists in the decades leading up to the Sherman Act of 1890 were systematically falling. Large entrenched firms, big conglomerations, trusts, and so forth, were losing market share to smaller, more innovative, more nimble competitors. And in fact, large industrial interests worked very closely with Senator Sherman and others to try to get laws passed that would help rather than harm their efforts to stay large and powerful. That the Sherman Act and the early antitrust laws were aimed more at highly innovative upstarts rather than already established incumbents. It was incumbents trying to protect themselves against new rivals that led to the establishment and the maintenance of the antitrust industry that we have today. Same thing with progressive era regulation, health and safety rules. There's a great study of the Pure Food and Drug Act, which was the first major U.S. law about food labeling and food safety. And everybody says, oh, well, obviously you need that to protect consumers, to keep food safe and healthy, right? Otherwise, the big meat packing companies would put, dog pieces in the meat, and chemical pharmaceutical companies would put poison in the pills and all this kind of stuff. It's been demonstrated quite convincingly by economic historians and political scientists that the rationale for the Pure Food and Drug Act was protect mom and pop butcher shops against more efficient established company, more efficient innovative companies like the Swift Corporation in Chicago. So the targets of these kinds of rules were the more efficient, more safe companies, and the rules were designed to exempt particular firms from having to meet these requirements, right? So mom and pop butcher shops lobbied for these rules to make sure they would maintain their own local monopolies at the expense of the more efficient and more innovative industrial meat packers like the Swift Corporation. So even in cases like food safety and health and safety regulation, the rules were designed not to protect the public, not to protect public health, but to benefit particular politically connected interest groups. And we saw the same thing with the cartelization of industry in World War I, New Deal agencies, World War I policies and so forth, right? So if we look historically at the U.S. and in other countries as well, at where regulations came from, how regulations came about, what purposes business regulations have actually served, we almost always find some kind of a partnership between particular business interests and the state. A useful quote from an unpublished letter of Murray Rothbard's from the 60s that I came across once when I was looking through Rothbard's, the archive of Rothbard's correspondence at the Mises Institute. Rothbard writes to a friend, "For some time, I have come to the conclusion that the grave deficiency in the current output and thinking of our libertarians and classical liberals is an enormous blind spot when it comes to big business. There's a tendency to worship big business per se, and a corollary tendency to fail to realize that while big business would indeed merit praise if they won that bigness on the purely free market," that's an important point, "in the contemporary world of total neo-mercantilism and what is essentially a neo-fascist corporate state, i.e. a highly interventionist economy according to Mises' taxonomy, business is a priori highly suspect, because big business most likely got that way through an intricate and decisive network of subsidies, privileges, and direct and indirect grants of monopoly protection." Okay, so two important points here, right? Rothbard says, you know, if business were to achieve its bigness on the purely free market, we should celebrate it. Right, so there's nothing inherently illegitimate about business on the big business on the free market. However, in practice, when one looks at the historical record, one finds that in most cases, big business got big not because it won the battle in the free market, but because it was able to use the state to its advantage. Right? Now, why would we expect firms to do that? Right? In an interventionist society, how can we expect firms to behave? How have firms, in fact, behaved? How big have they become? How have they organized themselves? How have their objectives or strategies changed? Well, I mean, some of this is pretty obvious, right? You know, the classic quote from P.J. O'Rourke, right? When buying and selling are controlled by legislation, the first things to be bought and sold are legislators. In other words, in an interventionist economy, you know, a business owner would be foolish, indeed would be naive, and maybe even fiscally irresponsible, you know, not to pay any attention to, you know, the interventions, right? I mean, if I'm a business owner in industry X and a particular intervention would hurt me relative to my competitors, well, of course, it would be in my interest to work hard to try to prevent that intervention from coming into place. And even more so, right, I mean, a trickier case, what if I could lobby or somehow influence legislators or judges or administrators, bureaucrats, to enact some business regulation, some intervention that would help me? Maybe not only at the expense of my rivals, but at the expense of consumers, at the expense of workers, at the expense of foreigners, and so forth. Now, right, I mean, as a business owner, right, and as an individual, I might think, and I personally would think, gosh, that doesn't seem right to me, right? I Peter Klein, right, I'm a libertarian. I think it's immoral to use, to initiate violence against non-aggressors. I believe in the non-aggression principle. And so if I could get the state to do X, Y, Z to put money in my pocket, I would have some hesitation about doing so, right? But if I'm, you know, the CEO of a company, if I'm the manager of an enterprise, I have a fiduciary responsibility to my shareholders, to the owners of the organization, and I might be violating my fiduciary duty if I fail to take action that would, you know, help the firm's bottom line. Right. So the point here is not to place sort of moral or ethical blame on business people who do the best they can in an interventionist system, rather to point out that we shouldn't expect any different. You know, if the rules of the game are designed in such a way that the only way to be successful is to work with the state, to use the state, or to try to keep the state away from these things and those things. Well, of course, we should expect as people play the game, they will do exactly that. Now, I want to talk for a few moments about some specific effects of government intervention on how firms are organized, how large firms can be, will tend to be, how they, what sort of legal structure they will adopt, because I think those are particularly important. I want to direct your attention first to the what I think are fantastic chapters in Mises' little book, Bureaucracy, on profit management, what he calls profit management, and what he calls bureaucratic management. If you haven't read Mises before, and you know, you don't feel quite up to taking on all 900 and whatever pages of human action, I would suggest that you start with Mises' Bureaucracy. It's a short book. It's an easy-to-read book. And I think it makes an extremely concise argument about the basic nature of capitalism and socialism. In fact, I think it provides a very nice summary of Mises' arguments in the socialist calculation debate, why he thought that a socialist economy or rational allocation of resources under socialism was impossible. The two chapters I asked you to read, you know, compare and contrast how enterprises operate, how business firms operate under the free market, under capitalism, and how they operate under interventionism, right? So the distinction that Mises is making is not so much between the objectives of a company, or certainly anything about the competence or the capabilities of the management of the company, but rather a very critical distinction between market and non-market activity. So the way Mises defines bureaucracy is different from the common sense, the common language definition, right? When we talk about an organization being bureaucratic nowadays, we typically mean, well, large, a lot of rules, a lot of layers, very hierarchical. But Mises defines bureaucracy in a more precise way. He says a bureaucracy is an organization that produces outputs which are not bought and sold on markets, right? So what do I have in front of me? Here's a stapler. I don't know if you can see this beautiful stapler. So a company that manufactures these staplers and then sells them in the market through Walmart or on the web or whatever, according to Mises, no matter how large that firm may be, no matter how many layers of middle management it may have, that is not a bureaucracy, because this firm can measure its performance based on profit and loss. How successful has the firm been in meeting its objectives of, you know, producing and marketing and servicing staplers? Well, you can tell by looking at, you know, the income statement. There's a bottom line. There's a measure of profit and loss. What if this is a firm, what if it's the police department, for instance? Right, so the police department is a very different kind of organization from the stapler company. It might be larger or smaller than a given police department might be larger or smaller than a given stapler company. It might have more or fewer layers of middle management. But the essential difference, according to Mises, is that there is no bottom line metric for how the police department is doing. Right? There's no profit and loss statement by which decision makers can evaluate the performance of the police department the same way they can with the stapler firm. Right? So Mises points out that, you know, a stapler company could be very, very large. Maybe it's divided into branches that serve different regions or different states or cities, or maybe different market segments, you know, consumer staplers, industrial staplers, and so forth. But Mises points out that the central management of a firm like that can delegate quite a lot of authority to local managers, to regional managers, give them a lot of latitude in day-to-day decision-making, because their performance can always be judged against this objective bottom-line standard. In the case of a bureaucracy, according to Mises, that cannot be done, right? You cannot say to the beat cop, well, hey, you know, you go out and do law enforcement however you know, however you feel it should be done. Use your local knowledge, use your Hayekian tacit knowledge to figure out what's the best way to maintain law and order, or arrest criminals or prevent crime or do whatever it is you're supposed to do, ostensibly, in your own neighborhood or on, you know, in your own city or whatever. We'll just judge you by the bottom line. Well, there is no bottom line, right? There's no profit and loss statement, and we wouldn't want there to be, right? We wouldn't want, to evaluate and promote police officers based on, you know, total amount of ticket revenue raised. You can see some obvious ways that would distort the policeman's incentive from doing what he's supposed to be doing. Now, notice Mises is not arguing that it's illegitimate for the government, for a non-market entity to provide police services. Mises, he assumes that that's completely legitimate. Society wants government-provided police, according to Mises. It's simply a question of how that organization should be managed and governed. Where there is no bottom-line measure of performance, according to Mises, the central managers have to provide a lot more specific direction for, you know, rank-and-file members of the organization, for people in the field or on the street. You have to give them fixed rules, less discretion, and more behavior according to prescribed rules and regulations, right? You guys have all watched, you know, movies or TV shows about detectives, you know, cop police shows. There are so many of them, right? And there's always a scene where, you know, the maverick rogue detective is, you know, called into the supervisor's office, the police captain's office, and the police captain yells at the hero, says, you know, just for once, I want you to do this by the book. You got to do this by the book, not your own way. You know, what is this book? What's the book they're always talking about, right? You wouldn't expect, the general manager of the Stapler Company to call in the Missouri regional manager and say, you need to do things by the book. You're always coming up with these crazy marketing schemes and promotional ideas and manufacturing techniques for your staplers in Missouri. You know, I don't want you doing that anymore, dirty hairy stapler man. I want you to make staplers by the book. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, right? There is no book in the stapler industry because the manager says, hey, if you guys are making a ton of money in Missouri. I don't know what you're doing. I don't know how you're doing it, but keep it up. You're adding a lot to our bottom line. Actually, you don't have that for the police.
Can I jump in for just a second on this?
You absolutely can.
Yeah, so one of the major problems that really, really large firms and organizations have is that they tend to develop a bit of sclerosis because they get bureaucratic and they start doing things by the book. So enormous Stapler Co. might have a by-the-book procedure, but the thing that's going to act as a check on that is competition as such. So if someone comes along, so if they get too bureaucratic and they get too unresponsive to the profit and loss signals of the market, then someone comes along, builds a better stapler, and eats Stapler Co.'s lunch. Indeed, this is something we'll talk about a little bit probably on Thursday. This is one of the things that has made Walmart so successful, is they, as I understand it, they basically give the regional managers a target and say, here's your sales number. However you get to it is totally up to you. We know nothing about the local market conditions that you face, but here's what you sold last year. We want you to increase by 3% and make the gap between revenue and cost as big as it can be.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, what's the optimal level of hierarchy? You know, to what extent should the central manager of Stapler Co., you know, grant latitude or discretion to a regional manager? Well, that's not something that we as economists or as analysts can say a priori, right? We say, well, we would let the market decide, right? But as Art points out, there is competition among stapler manufacturers, and Mises' fundamental point, there is a number against which we can make these comparisons. There are profit and loss figures that are the ultimate standards of performance. In the case of the police department, or, you know, the army or the state-run court or whatever it might be, we lack those measures. And therefore, it's important for the citizens, the leaders, the ultimate decision makers, the principals, if you want to use the language of principal agent theory, to lay down specific rules that must be followed. So, in other words, in the mixed economy, in the interventionist economy, we would expect firms, even for-profit firms, to be more bureaucratic in Mises' sense than they otherwise would be. Why? Because in the interventionist state, there are a number of policies that distort or diminish or otherwise mess up the value of profit and loss signals, the information content of profit and loss signals, right? If profit and loss has more to do with how effective you are at lobbying, how well, you know, what kind of cozy relationship you have with this senator or that representative, how good you are at dealing with the tax police or whatever, then we can no longer assume that the success of particular decision makers is tied to satisfying consumer wants, right? So Mises refers specifically to things like taxes and regulations that distort profit signals, laws that interfere with who you can hire and who you can fire, and the threat of sort of arbitrary antitrust or regulatory activity as parts of the policy environment that make firms more bureaucratic than they would be on the free market, more subject to the kind of sclerosis that Art mentioned, more likely to rely on fixed rules and procedures than discretion measured by profit and loss signals. We could also mention other factors. There's a great book by the law professor Mark Rowe at Harvard called Strong Managers, Weak Owners, that refers to laws in many countries. He's essentially comparing the U.S., Germany, and Japan, where in the U.S. there are very strict regulations against bank ownership of equity, right? So banks are not allowed to own companies in the U.S. the way they do in Germany and Japan, where you have Keiretsu and so forth, like we talked about last week. According to Rowe, one of the reasons that principal-agent problems are as severe as they are in large U.S. organizations is precisely because the government prevents large institutional owners like banks, like investment banks and commercial banks, from owning equities and exercising a kind of governance function. So firms become more bureaucratic or less responsive to customer demand because the government restricts those who might be able to exercise effective control against these organizations. What about the size of the firm? You know, this of course is one of the major themes of our course, right? We're talking about big business. Is it the case, theoretically, historically, empirically, that government intervention, tends to make firms larger than they otherwise would be on the free market? Recall that as we discussed last week, right, in a purely capitalist society, in a pure market society, without any government intervention affecting business, the optimal size of the firm depends on the relative transaction costs of internal and external exchange, the degree to which entrepreneurial judgment can be extended across multiple activities and multiple markets, and the de facto size of any particular firm would be determined by competition, right? Firms would compete against each other, and the more successful firms the optimal size of the firm would be whatever is the size of those firms that are more successful on the market. In other words, the market competition would determine firm size along with firm structure and firm organization and firm governance and so on. What about under interventionism? There's certainly a strong belief among many libertarians, and you get this from certainly the sense from Rothbard's letter, the quote that I read you before, that on balance, the net effect of government intervention in the U.S. in the 20th century has been to promote bigness. And there are a number of specific policies that we could point to, right? More generally, think of the costs of interacting with the state being, what economists would call fixed costs, right? Costs that do not generally depend on the volume of production, right? So the cost to set up a lobbying office, the cost to hire a tax specialist, to hire attorneys to deal with the regulator, and so on. assume that these costs are independent, at least within some range, of the number of staplers that you produce, right? Then that's one source of economies of scale in stapler production, right? You want to produce a lot of staplers so you can spread that lobbying cost out over a large number of units. So, you know, not only lobbying and communicating with the state, but even complying with particular state mandates, right? What I mentioned before about access for the disabled, you know, if the government is going to force me to install, you know, design the bathrooms in a particular way and to install wheelchair ramps, a large firm that can spread that fixed cost out over a lot of units is in a better position than a small firm that has to pay the same cost for the same wheelchair ramp but sells a smaller number of units. You might think of intellectual property protection, that the cost of protecting one's IP as being something else that favors, that promotes economies of scale and scope, and thus favors larger firms over smaller ones. Of course, there are any number of direct subsidies, right? You know, TARP bailout payments were not going to teeny tiny local banks; they were going to large national banks. Kevin Carson, who runs a blog called, is it mutualist.org? I've forgotten which blog it is. A writer who has often critiqued big business from a kind of libertarian perspective, emphasizes implicit subsidies or indirect subsidies like transportation, claiming that the only reason that high volume manufacturing and distribution, you know, big manufacturers, Walmart size retailers and so on, the only reason that's feasible economically is because we have government subsidized transportation in all countries. In the US, for example, you know, the interstate highway system, subsidies for the trucking industry and the rail industry and so on, that make volume production feasible. Whereas if companies had to pay the full cost of transportation on roads and so forth, they would end up being much more smaller and local than the sort of large national mass manufacturers and retailers that we have today. I think all of those points are valid and legitimate. But what we're interested in is not the sort of gross effect of government intervention, but the net effect, right? Because there are a lot of government policies that favor smaller firms, policies that hit large firms harder than they hit small firms, such as, you know, antitrust regulation, right? Which large firms are more likely to come under the antitrust radar than small firms. I mean, not just more likely, it's, you know, there's certain market share thresholds that trigger an antitrust investigation or antitrust action. What Fred McChesney, legal scholar Fred McChesney, calls rent extraction in his great book, Money for Nothing, rent extraction is the idea that politicians will threaten particular policies or rules that will hurt some large industry in expectation that the industry will respond preemptively by contributing money to politicians' campaigns, setting up lobbying offices, and so on. It's a kind of extortion payment, right? We saw this in the software industry in the U.S. I remember back during the 1990s when Microsoft was being investigated in a number of antitrust actions. You know, it was politicians expressed shock and dismay to find out that a company had grown as large as Microsoft but did not have a single lobbyist on the payroll, that Microsoft and other high-tech companies didn't even have Washington, D.C. offices. So how dare they think that they can do business in the U.S. without bowing down and paying homage to, you know, their Washington, D.C. overlords? And, of course, you know, during and after these antitrust cases, Microsoft did the rational response, which is to lobby like crazy and to start contributing huge amounts of money to politicians and to have a big Washington, D.C. lobbying office and so forth. So little firms don't have to do that. Politicians, the rent extractors, go after the big firms with deep pockets, not the small firms with shallow pockets.
If I can raise my hand again, that's something actually, again, that we can discuss in greater detail if y'all are interested on Thursday night. But Walmart, in fact, Sam Walton was called arrogant because he didn't want to play that game. And basically what happened is governments at the federal level and at the state level showed up and said, hey, it's a nice corporation you've got here. It'd be a shame if something happened to it. And, you know, that's literally, there's a story about Bill Clinton calling Walmart's home office and saying, hey, you know, we would really, really like it if you bought some shirts from this local Arkansas manufacturer. And, you know, sort of the implicit threat there is that this is a lot more than just a favor.
That's right. It's like when the Mafia Don says, you know, hey, Art Carden, you do a favor for me, I do a favor for you. Right? That also means if you don't do the favor for me, whack.
Right.
Anyway, there are a number of direct subsidies that go to small firms, business incubators, and small energy companies, and so on. Small business innovation research awards in the U.S. I'm sorry. I lost my train of thought for a second there. Art's point was so brilliant, I got distracted. What I also meant here was with energy and telecom, this idea, Kevin Carson's idea that transportation subsidies favor large-scale production, and in the absence of them, we would have much smaller, cottage industry, small mom-and-pop stores, little local manufacturers, small neighborhood co-ops, and so on, I think ignores the fact that those small cottage producers rely heavily on subsidized electricity and telecom, right? I mean, the only reason that electric providers, string wires all the way out to small towns and small communities, the only reason the telephone companies, had phone lines or, broadcast, towers and so on in low density population areas is because of government subsidy or government mandate, right? In a purely free society, in a purely free market, my suspicion is people would be more heavily concentrated in cities because the cost of delivering key infrastructure like energy and communication is much lower when populations are densely, when you have a densely concentrated, when you're densely populated. So I suspect these small mom-and-pop rural producers would not be economically feasible in the absence of government-subsidized energy and communication. Okay. Well, I want to stop and get in a few questions here. Let me just make a couple of points about limited liability because I know that people will ask, is it the case that the corporate forms specifically, are corporations an artificial product of the state? Is the corporate form the result of state subsidy and state intervention? That's a common argument that one hears in many libertarian circles, and I want to suggest some problems with these statements. First of all, remember we discussed last week the fact that all legal forms of organization, proprietorships, partnerships, cooperatives, unincorporated firms, incorporated firms, all of these different forms of organization have costs and benefits, all the business on so-called vaguely defined property rights, right? So yes, of course, there are principal agent problems. There are conflicts of interest between owners and managers in large, diffusely held corporations, but there are important conflicts of interest among key decision makers in partnerships and cooperatives and in all feasible forms of organization. But what's about specifically about corporations? I mean, it is true that incorporating in many jurisdictions can provide some tax benefit at the state or national level. But what a lot of libertarians have focused on is limited liability. And there's a big literature on this, and we don't have time to go into it in a lot, a huge amount of detail. But I want to point out first that how big a deal is limited liability, and is it the case that limited liability is the defining aspect of the corporation? Well, there's a legal scholar named Larry Ripstein, who unfortunately passed away just within the last 2 weeks, law professor at the University of Illinois, has a great book on what he calls uncorporations, looking at the law and economics of partnerships and proprietorships and cooperatives and other non-corporate forms. He points out that many of these are organized with limited liability as well. So limited liability is not exclusive to corporations. Many unincorporated businesses also have different kinds of limited liability protection. But the key point is, you know, there are two different kinds of limited liability, right? So there's limited liability against creditors, and then there's limited liability in relation to torts. So in the first case, in the former case, limited liability is simply a contractual arrangement between a firm and its creditors. So, I, you know, on a purely free market, Art Cardin and I could set up a firm, and we go to borrow money from the bank, and we say we're going to borrow X dollars. And say, look, as part of our arrangement, we hereby stipulate in the contract that if we go bankrupt, then you can only come after Art and myself for the amount of money that we have invested in the corporation as shareholders, right? You can't go after our personal assets. You can't go after my house and car and my kids' college savings account and so on. You can only recover money from me up to the amount that I have invested in the corporation as a shareholder. Right now, that's a purely voluntary proposal, right? I mean, the bank could say, yeah, okay, sure, fine. We'll lend you some money subject to those caveats. Or the bank might say, no, thank you, we're not willing to make that loan. Or we'll only make that loan at a much higher interest rate because there's another company down here. You know, Danny and Doug have another corporation, and they're coming to me, and they're asking for a loan, and they're saying, hey, if they go belly up, we can go after their personal assets. We'd rather make a loan to them instead of you guys. Or we'll make a loan to them on more favorable terms than we'll make to you. And so Art and I have to figure out, well, gosh, if we insist on protecting our personal assets from the creditor in the event of bankruptcy, well, that's good for us in that our, you know, our personal wealth is protected, but it means it's harder for us to get a loan. You know, do we want to do that? Well, we can discuss and debate. So there can be voluntary negotiation among the firm, its shareholders, its creditors, and other participants about how liability is to be assigned ex post, and this can all be negotiated contractually ex ante. So there's no need for any government action to bring about limited liability in that sense. What critics of limited liability typically have in mind is limited liability against tortfeasors, right? So, you know, the commonly used example, what if, you know, a FedEx truck, you know, hits somebody and you know, causes grave bodily injury to a pedestrian? Can the victim, you know, is only the truck driver liable for that harm, or are the shareholders of, you know, Federal Express liable? And critics like Kevin Carson and Roderick Long and others say that, you know, if it weren't for a limited liability, you know, people would be very reluctant to invest in a corporation because they wouldn't want to be personally liable. They wouldn't want their personal assets, their house and their savings account and so on, to be liable in case, you know, a truck driver of the company in which they have invested commits some kind of a tort. So that, according to Carson and Long, is an illegitimate subsidy for the corporate form of organization because the state grants shareholders limited liability against torts committed by employees of the firm, members of the firm, and that's a kind of an artificial subsidy that would not exist in a purely free market. This is a highly questionable view. It was addressed by Robert Hessen in his well-known book back in the 70s, In Defense of the Corporation. Stephen Kinsella has addressed this in several blog posts more recently, that it's not at all clear that shareholders should be responsible for torts committed by employees of corporations in which they have invested. There's an old legal doctrine of what's called vicarious liability and a centuries-old doctrine called respondeat superior, which holds that the master, which asks in what cases the master is responsible for actions committed by his servant. And critics of the corporation assume that shareholders should be responsible for all actions committed by employees of the corporation. But that, it's not at all obvious that that should be the case. Hessen argues, and Kinsella has argued, that in a more sort of conventional common law understanding of tort, the master is only responsible for the servant's action when the servant is acting directly on behalf of the master, engaged in activities that the master has a substantial amount of control over, right? And therefore, corporate shareholders investing small amounts of money in the corporation but exercising little day-to-day control should not, in a purely common law understanding, be responsible for torts committed by the truck drivers, right, who are not in any way acting at the under the direct authority of these shareholders. So to make a long story short, it's not at all clear that shareholders should have unlimited liability, and that therefore in a pure free market, whether it's governed by common law or by some kind of libertarian legal code, private protection agencies and so forth in the Rothbardian sense, the default rule would, in a case like that, would probably be that shareholders are not liable for torts. So it's not at all clear that state statutes granting limited liability are doing anything other than what the free market would have done even without the state. Okay, so I talked longer than I wanted to, but Art interrupted me so many times I couldn't help it. Takeaways, government does help big business, but it helps small business as well. Government policy has a lot of effects, diverse, complex, subtle effects on firm size and organization and strategy and performance. Corporations, as opposed to other, forms of organization, do, of course, benefit from the state, but corporations, in many ways, are harmed by the state as well. It's not obvious that limited liability is an artificial privilege of the state. And, kind of the bottom line, what would the firm look like on the purely free market? Would firms be smaller, less hierarchical, flatter, more like, would there be more co-ops and partnerships, as Roderick Long argues, on the free market? I think it's impossible to say ex ante. All we can do is let the market decide. And gee, it sure would be fun to give that experiment a run. So, okay, that's all I want to say for my formal remarks. I can see some comments in the chat and the Q&A. Let me turn to the question queue first. James asked a question about Mises' theory of interventionism. James, I'm going to, I'll come back to your question later if there's time, because I want to get to some more of the specific things on the corporation and so on first. If you just look at Mises' essay, Middle of the Road Leads to Socialism, I think that's where Mises makes the strongest case about this inherent instability of the interventionist state. Jim asks, Jim says in the debate with Roderick Long, Peter suggested that we just run the experiment. Yeah, like I just said. In other words, I think Roderick Long and I agree that it would be great to have a purely free market, and let's look and see if Roderick's right that there wouldn't be many corporations, or if I'm right that there would be a lot of corporations and a lot of large firms. Jim says, would cross-country studies of the relationship between firm size or measures of integration, like vertical integration, and measures of interventionism provide some insight here? Sure, absolutely. There isn't much empirical literature of that nature, partly because people who have looked at this have found it's very difficult to find kind of a uniform scale on which to measure the degree of government intervention where you could do some comparisons country by country, right? Just looking at the things that we've discussed tonight. It's not like the corporate tax rate is the primary form of intervention. We could do cross-country comparisons of average firm size and the tax rate. There's a whole complicated slew of government policies that have different effects on firm size and integration and incorporation and so forth. And I think it would be difficult to do that kind of a study, but of course I'd be all in favor of efforts in that direction. So certainly a good suggestion.
A very quick point. To underscore how difficult that is as an empirical issue, you've seen people who compare CEO compensation across countries and say we have this outsized difference between CEO compensation and worker compensation in the U.S. Tyler Cowen, I think, makes an important point that CEO compensation in other countries doesn't capture the value of non-monetary perks like job security, access to political power, and things like that, that a lot of firms or that a lot of CEOs in, of European firms, for example, have that American CEOs don't.
Yeah, so to put it another way, even measuring the behavior of the firm, firm size, the degree of integration, even measuring those things consistently across countries is a challenge. Measuring the, coming up with some metrics for the complex web of regulations that affect firms large and small would be, would be even more difficult. Another question from Jim. Should we be skeptical of some of the policies that I have listed as favoring small business, given that we often see big businesses pushing for these particular policies, like antitrust and disclosure laws? I mean, I want to be careful in how I answer. I mean, it's certainly true that if you look at the history of the Sherman Act, right, it was large incumbents who were, who were advocating the Sherman, advocating for antitrust rules, not smaller firms that we think would be harmed by antitrust. But if we want to look at, if we look at antitrust policy today, it's a little bit more complicated, right? Because the it's something that I mentioned in my exchange with Roderick, that there's sort of average and marginal effects. Right. So if a particular, let's say that a particular set of policies currently favors, firms of type A at the expense of firms of type B, right? Well, we might see firms of type B lobbying very hard to get that policy changed because they would benefit more from the change, even though firms of type A benefit most from the status quo, right? So what we have to look at is, what do different types of firms benefit from changing the regulations, right? It may be that the present level of regulation systematically favors firms of type A, right? And because they're satisfied with the status quo, they're not doing anything to try to get it changed, whereas firms of type B are lobbying very hard to change the status quo, even though at present they're not affected by the regulation very much. I think that's part of the answer to your question as well, Jim. But, I mean, of course, I'm generalizing when I speak about policies that I'm talking about broad categories. So there are some kinds of regulations, some kinds of disclosure policies that may, in fact, favor big guys over little ones, even though in the more general case, look at Sarbanes-Oxley, for example, in the U.S. Sarbanes-Oxley clearly favored large firms at the expense of small firms because the cost of complying was very, very high for the small firms, and there were attempts made to exempt small firms from Sarbanes-Oxley rules. But, right, Sarbanes-Oxley only affects firms that are publicly listed on the stock market. So within the set of publicly listed firms, the big guys benefit relative to the small guys, but a lot of firms chose not to become publicly listed, rather to remain private so that they would not be subject to Sarbanes-Oxley kinds of disclosures. So it's hard to give a very clean come up with a sort of a simple statement about the effect on large versus small, because we have so many different types of firms, both large and small. Okay, the basic argument, the basic point that I'm making, of course, is that because the regulations are so complex, the only way their effects are so complex, the only way we can really decisively say what's the net effect of big government on business is, again, to kind of run the experiment. There's some questions in the chat window as well. Let me see if I can see these. Okay, Art's got a good point about McDonald's. Let's see. Yeah, good quote from Mises on double entry bookkeeping. That's from in our discussion of, you know, what Mises calls profit management versus bureaucratic management, right? Let's see if I can make this window bigger. There we go. Yeah, great passages here from Mises in Human Action on he's elaborating the point that he made in bureaucracy on the way that in a market setting, large firms can use accounting, they can use profit and loss calculations to keep their firms from being inefficient meaning too large, top heavy, or whatever. I don't know if the line's in here somewhere. Somewhere else in Human Action, where Mises says he quotes Goethe to the effect that double entry bookkeeping is, you know, one of the greatest advances in human civilization. It was a nice little, you know, plug for the accounting profession, which normally doesn't get much respect. Rudy. there's a private comment. No, my only comment is no, but I am on some cold medicine. I have a little bit of a sore throat, so maybe Sudafed is making me more peppy than I usually am. Art has a point on limited liability, which I'll just leave for discussion. Let me see if anything here are questions. Okay, no, it doesn't look like specific questions, more discussion points. And anybody, feel free to jump in. I agree that Sanford Akita's book on the mixed economy is a good one to look at, elaborating on some of Mises' points in this Middle of the Road Leads to Socialism article.
Actually, that raises, I have sort of a question about sort of the finer points of libertarian theory. Because I raised this point in the discussion or in the chat room about how firms that hire people who commit a lot of torts are likely to expose themselves to liability, and this is going to reduce stock prices and things like that. And I mentioned there's some empirical evidence that the firms that hired Tiger Woods as a spokesperson saw decreases in their stock value after it was determined that he was doing things he probably shouldn't have been doing. Yeah, I wonder then, does this suggest that formal legal liability for torts on the part of shareholders wouldn't matter?
That's an interesting question. Your point, tell me if I'm understanding, your point is that even in the absence, even with limited liability,
right,
shareholders have an incentive to invest in firms that do not, you know, systematically hire tortfeasors,
right,
but don't hire crazy, reckless people as truck drivers,
right,
that firms committing torts, that lowers the value of the firm, it lowers the value of the stock, and so on. I mean,
right.
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense to me. I don't know that that would be a substitute. In other words, I don't know that that would make limited liability rules irrelevant, in the sense, mm-hmm, you know, you know, I might get a lower rate of return investing my stock in a company that hired, you know, still has Tiger Woods as its spokesperson, but I might make a positive return. I might still invest. Whereas if I'm afraid that what's her name, Tiger Woods' wife, you know, if I were afraid that, you know, she could somehow sue me, you know, in response to Tiger Woods' various indiscretions, then I might be unwilling to invest at all. So I think these are two different factors. The point you're raising, Art, pushes in sort of the same direction, but maybe wouldn't be a perfect substitute for liability rules. Yeah, I mean, no matter what the default rules are for who's liable for the commissions of this or that kind of tort, it's certainly the case that there are market-like incentives,
right,
for firms to engage in behaviors that not only are to the benefit of consumers, but also make it easier to attract shareholders and, you know, policies that lower the cost of capital. A question from Jim, wouldn't the stock price fall even more in the absence of limited liability? Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I have to think that through. The question is, what's the sensitivity of stock price? What would the sensitivity of stock price to various kinds of corporate misbehaviors be in the absence of limited liability? Would shareholders, you know, likely pull out sooner if they were afraid that their own assets would be at risk? I mean, my knee-jerk response is, yeah, I guess so. It's an interesting point. I'd certainly want to think through a little bit more.
Well, I know you have some of your grad students who are in on this. So I would suggest that when they knock on your door and discuss this after the course is over, it's this question about maybe all roads leading back to Coast, because you get you probably get a change in the governance institutions or a change in the monitoring institutions, where yeah, presumably in a world of full liability, a firm would want a little bit more control over, or a little bit more insight into the private lives of the people that they're hiring as spokespeople or what have you. So it'd be kind of like the social control that existed as a result of Henry Ford's $5 day. But you know, that might be something. I'll mark this down. This might be something we could talk about on Thursday.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point. I would put it a little bit differently. That if the default legal rule was unlimited liability for shareholders, then first there would be fewer shareholders, right? I mean,
Right. Many
people on the margin would prefer not to invest in equity shares in companies. And number two, those who do invest would probably want to exercise a lot more oversight, right? So people would concentrate their stock holdings in fewer companies so they could have more effective voting control and so forth, and they would go to more board meetings, and they would engage much more in what they would become what Michael Jensen calls active investors, rather than, you know, look, a lot of you guys probably have, guys and gals, you may own some stock, probably almost all of you own some stock in a retirement portfolio or something like that, and you probably don't pay a whole lot of attention to it. If I own a few shares of stock in IBM, and I'm not going to show up at the IBM shareholders meeting because it isn't worth it. But I only am willing to make that kind of investment and be a passive investor because I know that worst case scenario, I'm going to lose the value of that investment, but not much more. If I thought my house were at stake as well, I'd be a much more active participant in monitoring and governance. Now, you know, how big a deal would this be? How much would it hurt industry? You know, the conventional answer is that limited liability, allows firms to raise a lot more capital at a lower cost. There's some debate among both theoretically and empirically about how big a deal this really is. Hessen points out, I think it's in the little article that you read too, that most of the large industrial enterprises. The large enterprises that were organized during the commercial and industrial revolutions, most of them were partnerships. They were unlimited liability partnerships. They were not joint stock companies. There were a few important joint stock companies, or the East India Company, of course, but most of the large industrial enterprises, the first big manufacturers and so on, were organized as partnerships where the partners had unlimited liability. So it's not at all clear that limited liability was somehow necessary for the growth of the large industrial enterprise. Okay, I guess it's 7:31, and we started at about 7:31 my time, and we started at about 6:01, so I guess that's 90 minutes. Well, thanks to everybody for great questions and discussion. Thanks to Art for all your help, and thanks to Danny and Doug for making everything work so smoothly from a technical point of view. A PDF version of the slides is now available, or will soon be available, on the course website. And as before, I look forward to continuing this conversation with any of you guys one-on-one or in groups by email. If you want to set up a private chat, just drop me a note. And I look forward to Art's lecture on Thursday.
All right. Should be wonderful.
See you later, everybody.
All right. See everyone on Thursday.